Welcome back to Brandland. Today we're jumping back in time to break down episode 2 of the Wheel of Time TV show on Prime. So originally, as you know, we had a little screening party. You're Amarlyn Jay, my co-host Mihail Colin, and our counterpart to Grain of Twitter of Time. And we gave our immediate reactions to episodes 1 through 3, but now we're revisiting to do deep dive for each of them. So we're going to start it off with a spoiler-free breakdown, and later we'll be joined by Tigrain, where we'll be full of spoilers, nerding out with our book knowledge, and just comparing and contrasting our reactions from our first watch, which should be interesting. So, Colin, welcome. Excited to talk about this one with you.
Absolutely, yeah. This will be good. It's a good episode. So, I mean, they're all good episodes.
It is. they're all good.
They're all good.
So, once again, this is episode 2. It's titled Shadows Waiting. This one was directed by Uta Brisewitz, who also did the pilot episode. And the story of the episode was written by Rafe Judkins himself, and it was adapted for the screen by Amanda Kate Schumann. Who I'm starting to really like as a writer. Like, I feel like her and Rafe are a good team. And revisiting this one, like, my first impression was, wow, they got so much in there and actually, like, so much from the books, like, as a book fan. So I was excited to go back and watch this one. Cinematography was by David Moxness. I am still not a fan, and I'll touch on that later. So jumping into our spoiler-free segment, first, the episode starts with a cold open. We're in a Children of the Light / White Cloak camp. And we see a young child in a livery delivering a cloche to Aemon Valda, one of the questioners of the White Cloaks. And we see that there is a woman tied to a burning stake in front of him. It's later revealed she has no hands, that he cut them off and they're like on a stump nearby. And he's really, enjoying the occasion. He opens the cloche and reveals this bird, which I looked up. I don't know if you knew about this, but it's called a Ortolan, and I did recognize it, I realized later, from two other shows. One is Succession and the other is Billions. So both shows with like extremely wealthy, like 1% powerful people.
Oh Jesus. What now?
Ortolan.
What's Ortolan?
It is a deep fried songbird. You eat it whole.
Oh my god.
This is like a rare privilege, and it's also kind of illegal.
So it is kind of appropriate, I feel like, that he's eating this animal as he's also, like, butchered this woman, and he's really reveling in both. So this is our, like, first introduction to the White Cloaks and Aemon Valda. And, you know, I feel like here at Randland, we've been big fans of all the cold opens, and they're all been quite different. So, yeah, Colin, any thoughts on this opening scene?
You know, yeah, rewatching it, like, I really like this cold open. The thing that really gets me in first is the music, kind of when that wide shot that comes down into the camp, that opening shot. I really like the music. And it's used again a little bit later. But that really gets me into it, and I think it's appropriate because there's something, the music itself is eerie, but there's something incongruous about the music and coming into this camp that it looks really pristine and orderly and kind of like, why would it have this weird music? And then you get this character and it's like, oh shit, yeah. this guy's dark. I really like that part. And I think it's a great character introduction for sure.
Yeah, for sure. He's very intimidating.
Yeah.
But collected, cool, calm, and collected. And we get the sense that there is an Aes Sedai on the stake who he refers to as like a witch, but she's wearing yellow. And at this point we don't like know that much about Aes Sedai, but we can see that clearly Moraine's, you know, traipsing around in her cobalt jacket everywhere. And, it kind of like with how saturated the costumes are, it's made me want to dig into I mean, this is not a historical drama, but like the practices of making textiles, just because I feel like the way the colors are so saturated, that would be like a very modern, like technological sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like they're just so bright and saturated. It doesn't look like a natural kind of dye to me or something. But I don't know.
Agree with that. But also I think that we have to keep in mind that this isn't necessarily our historical past. You know, yeah. Like it's a different turning the wheel. So maybe there is some technology that allows them to do that. In that context, yeah, something I don't know.
Weave where they found like a box of Crayola crayons in a stasis box, and then they're like, apply that like Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah.
So this is our cold open. We're in the White Cloak camp, and then we cut to the first title sequence that we get of the series, because we don't see the title sequence in the pilot episode. I was a fan from the beginning. I like this concept of using the threads of the pattern and showing us the warp and the weft, and like doing that in a creative way for the opening title sequence for the series. It's a nice change from like a map or collage-y type things that other shows have done. And the music's nice too, obviously.
Yeah.
Lauren
Bach. No, it's a great opening sequence. I really like it. It's really good.
Brava. Yeah. So diving straight into the episode, we have an opening scene, and I realized, you know, as a book fan, I keep calling them the, you know, Amond Fielders, and I need to start calling them the Two Rivers Four. But it's like, okay, so we open, we have our Two Rivers Four. They're traveling with Lan and Moraine. In the previous episode, we see them leave the Two Rivers, and so now we see them fleeing. They're crossing kind of like a shallow riverbank. It's sort of icy spring landscape, and we get a sense that the Trollocs and Shadowspawn are like not far behind. And, you know, as soon as they cross, we get this other shot of the Trollocs crossing the same bend, and a nice close up of my favorite Trolloc, who I call Bunny, because he's on all fours. He like looks to the camera and then like hops away. And I just think he's so cute. So we get right into this flight, this pursuit. They're fleeing. And we get the sense that time has passed, because they eventually arrive and it's nighttime. They arrive at Terran Ferry. And we meet Master Hightower, the ferryman. And I'm just going to jump right in and say that upon rewatching this, I really don't like the casting of Hightower. And I feel like it's something I didn't like give much thought to, you know, originally. But watching the scene play out, because there's so much I like about the sequence of them crossing the ferry, getting away from the Shadowspawn. But like, it's not a good performance. Like they use a lot of like ADR, like they added sound bites after, but it's like he's reading from a teleprompter. Like there's just like, it's just like awkward, especially because like Rosamund Pike's such a good actress. And I don't know, it was like, there's a part where they meet and he's like, you know, you don't seem like you seem like a woman who gets what she wants, you know? And it was like, it just came across odd. And then when they're crossing the ferry and they see all these fucking terrifying Trollocs in the Murdral, he's just like unfazed. He has like the same tone.
What are they?
Servants of the Dark.
And he's like, oh, my family, no. Like, it's so bad. Like, it jumped out to me because I love everything else about this scene, honestly. Like, it is straight from the books. Mm-hmm. You know, they get on the ferry. We very clearly see that Trollocs cannot pass deep water, because like they're all pushing each other forward and one falls and we see him like very like wheeze and whine as he like drowns and like flails in the water, right. And then we see the Fade come forward, and I really liked this part. I know it was used in some of the teasers, but the skull like helmet that's on the horse, I think, is so effective. And the fade, like, opening his crazy mouth and screaming, or her mouth, we don't know. They're hot, that's all we know. But yeah, I don't know. Did you like this part? Did you find it like effective? Was there anything that stuck out to you?
Yeah, I do like this part. I think specifically, like, going back to kind of talking about the deep water, like, and the way that they kind of drive that home, like, I think because the opening shot, the opening shot of that sequence is them crossing some water as well, but it's very shallow water. It's like a stream, you know? So I think that, I feel like that was purposeful. Like, okay, these are the parameters, you know, like, they can do this, but they can't do that, you know?
Yeah.
So I like that part. But speaking specifically to like the entrance of the fade, like, it's great. It's like highly effective. Like this slow kind of like him, like walking up, or them walking up on their horse, and like, and then just kind of looking, and then that scream. It's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I really like the sound design in this spot, in this part too. Yeah. So I'll talk more about this in like the spoiler section, but you know, this is a scene from the books, and it is interesting. Basically, they make it across the river, Shadowspawn on the other side, and then Moraine does her thing to like sink the ferry because she's like, we can't give them a way to cross. We can't go back. And Hightower obviously like chases after it. And we get the reactions from the Two Rivers kids. Perrin is kind of accepting of reality. I get the same sense from Rand. They keep cutting to Rand, like between the fade and Rand, which I thought was interesting. Like this almost sort of like face-off moment. And Egwene is the one who's grappling with reality of like, do something, save him. And, you know, and they're like, it's done. Like, oh, come on, we gotta go, you know? And in the books, this is like, you know, so much has happened to them and they've just left their home after this attack. And, you know, they see, collateral damage for the first time. So I think it does like set up this, a different dynamic with them and Moraine. Like they don't know whether to trust this person. Like they're seeing the one power used, like, is kind of overwhelming, but they do get one step away from the Shadowspawn, which is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's also that moment, like, when they're leaving the river, they're leaving, like, the Terran Ferry behind, or the Terran behind, and Rand and, like, Lan have this moment, like, this, like, kind of, they look each other in the eye. Do you know what moment I'm talking about? It's, like, right
yeah,
in there.
I have
it's, like,
it.
The end of the shot.
Yeah, I had that written down too. I want to talk about it more with Zoe, but like,
okay,
I was like, I was wondering like, what is up with that? Because they start on like a wide of both of them, like land on his, like, you know, in the forest and then Rand, and then they cut in like closer to their reactions. And I'm like, they're just staring at each other. I'm like, what is being exchanged? Like what is being exchanged right here? Yeah. It was interesting. Some of the editing.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. So, one thing I was going to say, like, from a high level that I noticed is, as we're going through the episode, you know, it starts, I'm not going to say from, like, Moraine's point of view, but, like, she's leading them, and she's keeping her strength up, and we see as the episode goes on that Moraine's strength is diminishing until, like, the point where, you know, she's, like, unconscious, and, like, Lan has to lead, and that gives opportunity for the Two Rivers kids to like have more POVs and more time spent like talking with one another and like having roles individually, which I appreciated in this episode. So like after this big fairy scene, you know, they continue their journey, but they make camp and they're resting, and there is a scene where we get the four of them talking around the campfire and taking a moment to sort of like digest and react to what's happening, which I felt was nice and realistic. And I think that when I first watched, you know, we all watched the first three episodes together, which is a lot to watch in a night also. But, you know, there were early reviews, there were other content creators saying a lot of things. And I feel like when I watch it now, I can form my own thoughts and reactions more clearly, whereas like, it's hard not to take in to account what other how other people are reacting and saying, like, this feels really rushed. I feel like I have no time with the characters, like, what's going on with them? And then rewatching it, I was like, oh, I feel like they delivered so much. Like, the writers did a lot of heavy lifting in this episode to help us understand what's going on with each of these kids individually, mm-hmm. and how what their dynamic is like together, you know. Mm-hmm. So like when they're sitting, yeah. So I was just gonna say, like, it was nice when they're sitting around. Like Matt brings up Nynaeve. I don't think he's totally like convinced Nynaeve is down and out. Egwene's like processing it, like accepting her death, and mm-hmm. Matt, you know, he does joke around a lot this episode. He is like, it's still dark, but he has like really great quips and comic relief. But he was saying he wished Nynaeve was there, like, to drive Moraine crazy and like question everything. Perrin is obviously like very in his head. He's the most withdrawn. He says, "Don't worry, Egwene, she probably died quickly." Like, oh, thanks, thanks, Perrin. but then their conversation turns to the dragon, you know, and they are like questioning this, and you know, Matt makes a joke about the dragon having wings, and Moraine's like, "You don't know anything." She interrupts them, but Egwene is sort of believing it, and I think that's interesting. Like, she's the most accepting. Rand and Matt are the most skeptical. I think Perrin's just like not really thinking that much about it. And I think I see a little bit, I don't know, like, if Egwene just needs someone to trust right now, or if maybe she thinks maybe she's the dragon. Like, I don't know. But she seems a little excited and like believing to me. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, wait, this is non-spoiler. Okay, so yeah, so I think that just to kind of go back to the books, I think maybe some of it is just like the excitement of going on a journey, you mm-hmm. know, of like leaving and like doing something. I think there's a little bit of that, but I think there's also the anxiety of what the fuck are these things following us, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's there's the excitement of being out of the town. But like the tone of that is heightened by the anxiety of these fucking demons following us, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's a little bit of that. Which isn't to say that she isn't kind of like, you know, a little gung-ho about it maybe, but I think I don't think it's all that, you know. I think it's a number of things, a confluence of things.
Yeah, totally. But I think like they're all processing this information and what's happening to them, and it's sort of like the beginning of widening the rift between Egwene and Rand. Obviously, like, they had their whole boyfriend-girlfriend crisis before they left, with her wanting mm-hmm. to be a Wisdom. Then the Wisdom, her mentor, was, you know, taken by a Trolloc, and she lost her. So, you know, I think Egwene is sort of, like, thinking to the future. And so when they make camp for the night, and Moraine taps her, wakes her up, and Rand is awake and knows that this is happening. Do they show him spying on them, or does he like overhear, like, when they go to the woods? Okay.
No, he just sees
informed.
No, he just sees them walk away, and then while they're gone, he changes sleeping locations.
Yeah. Okay. But I feel like he has an idea of what's happening. You know,
why?
Like, because of his attitude the next day. I mean, I don't know. I guess he doesn't know what they... Well, okay, so I'll break it down, and then I'll explain. So Moraine takes Egwene to the woods, teaches her about the three oaths, and then they do a little exercise, and she, like, reveals that Egwene is able to touch the One Power and channel. And then when they go back, Egwene, you know... and Moraine says, like, you know, you're not an Aes Sedai, but you could be. And then when Egwene goes back to bed, Rand has changed sleeping locations. She tries to snuggle with him, and he's like, I came out here to be alone. And she's like, okay, I understand. Then, you know, everyone goes to sleep, and we cut to Rand having this dream where he starts hacking, coughing, and then he coughs up an entire bat. And then we see a man come out, like, scary nightmare man with, like, eyes of fire. And in the morning, Rand wakes up, and there's just, like, fucking bats everywhere. Mm-hmm. And he finds his traveling companions, and it's revealed that they, like, all had this dream with, like, similar things, and they're telling Moraine about it. And, you know, Moraine is very characteristically, like, cryptic about it, like, dreams are dangerous. Tell me if they happen again. All right, let's go. And they're like, wait, we just like coughed up bats all night. Like, but Rand says, did you do this? Like, did you put this in our dreams? And there's this confrontation between Rand and Moraine that is really intense.
Horse is arrested.
No! Where are we going?
East. To the river crossing at Whitebridge.
And then?
And then to the White Tower. I've told you this.
And then what? Why should we trust you? There's a place for Egwene, maybe. But what does a man do at the White Tower?
It's a great scene. Great scene, by the way.
It's so good.
Yeah.
They all had great moments, but I feel like Rand really stood out in this episode.
No, Yosha, he was killing it. For sure.
Fuck yeah. But he starts to question, like, what is our plan? Where are you leading us? And she's, you know, we're going east, we're going here, then we're going to the White Tower. So I think he has a suspicion of, like, what's happening or why Moraine would tap her. Maybe he doesn't know she can channel, but I just think, like, in the books he does listen in on the conversation, but we don't see that on screen here. But I think, like, for Rand, he's, like, kind of losing Egwene again. Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. This is me, could be me projecting, but I feel like after all this shit has happened, he might have had some, like, renewed hope. You know, like, she's not going to be a wisdom now. Like, their lives are altered, you know? We don't know what the future is. But now it's, like, she's on a new career path. And he's like, God damn it. Like, why do you have to be so ambitious?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I also think it's fair, you know, like, like their lives have been drastically changed by no choices of their own, due to a circumstance that they didn't even exist like 2 days before, you know. So for him to like have the only things that he knows and understands, the only people he knows and understands, be broken up again, I think it's reasonable for him to be upset about that.
Yeah. And she, like, it's funny, this was a big shift for me from the first time I watched episode 2 to this time, watching it with fresh eyes, is that I think I immediately, like, sort of sided with Egwene in this argument. Not that, like, Rand's frustrations weren't valid, but, you know, there's another argument that they have after this where, like, Rand is, like, really, like, pushing her away because he feels hurt and guarded. But in this argument, he was like, you've had one conversation with her, one conversation, and now, like, you agree with you're, like, on her side. And I empathized more with Rand this time around because I could understand, like, they did just leave. And throughout this episode, Matt is actually trying to kind of hold them together and be like, we just have each other, you know, and he's trying to keep spirits up and stuff. And even like Matt is even really tactful with Rand in this scene and is like, hey, I hear you totally. Like, you're not wrong to question this, but right now, this is what we need to do. Like, he guides him. But Egwene digs in, is just as stubborn as Rand. And watching it, like, I forgot this, but she says, Moraine's doing all this stuff for us. She says she does it even with you being the stubborn bastard you are. Yeah. And if I were her, I'd leave you behind, too.
Yeah.
And Rand says rough. You already have. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
That's rough. That's good writing. I like that.
Yeah. No. We have to talk about the scene with Tigraine also.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I just thought it was funny that, like, you know, this isn't a spoiler, but I would say, like, Matt in the books is not, like, the most stand-up guy. He's not the guy that's gonna hold the group together or, like, be tactful and be the voice of reason. So I thought it was funny and, like, kind of an interesting shift that he is more mature in that way. Like, he is a very, like, kind of open with his friends and like being supportive and stuff in this episode. You see it like in a few different instances. So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was gonna say the same thing. That's true.
Yeah. But Egwene is very characteristically like the books. Like this scene, I was like, oh, yeah, this is why people don't like Egwene early on. Or,
yeah. No, I think that's true. I think, especially kind of like looking at what we were talking about, like her eagerness and as it relates to this whole scenario. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a shift after she has that conversation with Egwene or with Moraine, and she realizes that she could become an Aes Sedai, you know, she could be a channeler.
Yeah.
I think that Rand is right, you know, like, mm-hmm. it's not that, like, I think that he's right to question why she's going along with it so quickly, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not that they shouldn't do what she's saying, but, like, you gotta at least question it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's fair, for sure.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's funny, because I feel like in the book, Moraine would never be like, one of you is a dragon reborn, that's why I want you, like, right away, but, in this one, like, they know it's one of them, and they know what happens to men who channel to an extent, mm-hmm. like, even living out in the Two Rivers, like, they know mm-hmm. about these things. And, yeah, like, Rand's a man. He's like, why would I follow you blindly? And Matt's like, yeah, we can get out of here, you know, as soon as it's not in our interest.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Cool. So, moving on, as they travel east, they encounter the White Cloaks. So we see some new faces. One is Jefferm Bornhold, and he, you know, stops them. We see Aemon Valda also in this scene, the Questioner. And, you know, as the group, the Two Rivers and Moraine and Lan are approaching, Moraine coaches them. She takes her ring off, hands it to Lan, tells them, like, you know, you're traveling with me, I'm visiting, so, you know. She gives them a cover story, which was really good. Like, I feel like she handles the White Cloaks like a true Aes Sedai. And, you know, Rosamund Pike has to do this performance where she's like an Aes Sedai pretending to be.
Right, you know, the layered performance. Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, when she's describing the Trollocs and, like, she like, holds her hand up, she's like, they had face like monsters, you wouldn't believe me. Like, I was like, yeah, she's killing it. Like, she's so good. And I really enjoyed the tension in the scene, and I thought it was, like, well played.
It was a good scene. I had a question about the scene, and I guess I just, maybe it's just a difference in, maybe it's just an adaptation difference, but I feel like in the books, people are hesitant to even mention, like, you don't mention Dark Friends. You just don't say mm-hmm. it, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want even any association with the concept, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, I think people would be hesitant to just say the word Trolloc, you know? Like, mm-hmm. and I feel like, and maybe this is, again, like, maybe this is a matter of the adaptation, but, like, if you were to say that to White Cloaks in the books, I feel like the White Cloaks would be like, well, obviously you deserve Trollocs. Why are Trollocs following you, your Dark Friend? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was weird to me that she would bring up Trollocs, but I guess maybe they're just more reasonable in the TV show. I don't know.
I felt like maybe she couldn't get around. I mean, she calls them monsters and she's like, you wouldn't believe me, but I think it's because she couldn't lie. So that was, like, the closest she could get to it. Mm. And I mean, I agree. That's why I was like, but I honestly think it's just because it was Jefferm Bornhold, and had it been a different group, like, we're probably getting, like, a false sense of security. But I think it is setting up a good.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah.
It is setting up that tension between, like, the Questioners and even the way Valda kind of treats Bornhold. You know, you don't get the sense that they're best friends. You know, Bornhold's like, aren't you going to go investigate the Trollocs? And he's like, that's your job. We have a higher purpose. And it's like, okay. But the opening scene shows us them being kind of almost like cult-like or like religious zealots, and that they're very firm in their beliefs. And I think they're, like, doing the right thing, like burning witches. And they walk in the light. Like, they firmly believe that. But they're also human and men in, like, different ways. So it seems like, I think if she ran into anyone besides Bornhold, it probably would have been a different story. Yeah. But I think Valda's like on his best behavior because he can't do like do anything. They can't just like. I think they'll get bolder. Also, I would say.
Yeah.
You know what?
I mean, yeah. I mean, we know that Valda gets bolder, but yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So. It was a nice way to set up, like, since Moraine has to have that cover story, immediately after Egwene questions her and is like, you lied. You know, she's like, you broke the three O's. And yeah, Moraine's, right. Like, ooh, teaching her towel. About, yeah. Yeah. It was pretty funny. She's such Egwene's narc. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, right.
As they're galloping, we do get, like, a shot of kind of like a ancient city, like, oh, we see like an old broken bridge and some sort of like tall buildings. And then we get to this really lovely scene. The story of Mnethryn.
We walk the footsteps of our fathers, the trail blazed by our mothers. They bought the land with their blood long ago. Long ago, oh, sing of Mnethryn, oh, weep for the blood of Aemon, oh, cry for Mnethryn, long ago, long ago.
It's good to remember Mnethryn.
In the books, it unfolds differently. Here, it unfolds while they're on horseback. Matt kicks off singing this old song that everyone in the Two Rivers knows, of this kind of legend or myth, and Moraine explains to them what it means. And this is like a really important, I don't know if important is the right word, but beloved part of the books. And in the extras, like the behind the scenes of the show, Rafe says that this is a point where a lot of fans like fell in love with the Wheel of Time. Just like when they hear the story and the world building. But the Two Rivers kids find out that, you know, they live in the Mnethryn in the mountain home. Like that is their heritage. And you can tell that like Lan and Moraine are kind of excited by this. Like when they start singing, they're like exchanging these looks, like what? And she says, the old blood runs deep in you, remember that in the days to come. I loved the way this played out, basically, like, and the kids nailed it. What do you think?
Oh yeah, it's a great scene. It's a fantastic scene. I think it's something that like both new fans and book fans watching this episode, I think, were really enamored with. And I remember it being like almost being cut. Like I think it was one of those scenes that was like teetering on like, are we gonna put this in or not? And thankfully they decided to put it in.
Think Rafe fought for it.
Yeah. I think
and they tested it. They made him fucking put it in testing and then it tested well and he was like, I told you.
I think that it sets up some really crucial information. So I think that's really good. And just kind of like, maybe not necessarily like pivotal information, but stuff that kind of like speaks to the genius that was Robert Jordan in creating this story, you know, that I think is really nice to, when you can keep that stuff in there. I think that's really nice. So I appreciate it. And hopefully new fans will appreciate it too.
Yeah. There's a lot of good world building in this episode that doesn't feel exposition-y, like they did it in more organic ways, and you learn a lot of information about the world, which I appreciated. So as they continue their journey, they've sort of gotten like a little bit of a leg up on the Trollocs that are chasing them, so you know they rest at a few different places, just breaking them off into their little subplot lines. There's a point where Perrin goes off, like they're doing errands, like collecting water and collecting sticks for firewood and stuff like that. And Perrin's going off. And we've seen that he has this like wound on his leg that he's hiding from everyone. What? Why do you think that is? Do you have any speculation about why Perrin has this like open wound that he will not properly tend?
Oh my god, this fucking wound. Okay, I. You know what? I'm so mad about this thing, and I can't talk about it yet. Like, we have to wait until Zoe's on. I mean, honestly, it feels just like it feels like some sort of like obvious metaphor for me. That's really all it really reads as is like, oh, he killed his wife and now he's hurt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Inside, he's hurting inside, mm-hmm. so he has a leg wound. Like that's how it reads. Very much just mm-hmm. that. I really can't offer anything more than that, unfortunately. Yeah.
I felt like it's his punishment. You know, like he's embracing that pain right now because he feels like he deserves it. It's maybe that's like fair. A distraction or something that's like helping him cope and like focusing on that physical pain.
Right. That's fair. That's actually reasonable, but it's still,
I don't think it's a great choice at all. I'm going to be. It's like, oh, Perrin, he's got really bad eczema. He's always scratching.
Oh my God.
Okay. So, we get a wolf scene, you know, Perrin's got he's in private so he can reveal his flesh wound. He has his like pants rolled up and we see a pack of wolves roll up and they're growling at him and he's just staying like very still like, oh fuck. And then one kind of like I can't tell if it was just like muddy or if it had like a dappled coat, but obviously like the leader of the pack approaches him. He's like ready for it to bite his leg off, which is maybe what he's been hoping for as he's been limping across the Westlands. And instead the wolf licks his wound and then rejoins the pack and they run away and howl into the night. And it leaves Perrin very stunned and confused. I know it wasn't your favorite scene, and I know we'll talk about it more with Zoe, but I rewatching it, I mean, it's not my favorite, but I did think, like, this wolf just called him out. She, like, she didn't do anything to, like, thoroughly clean it. She just, like, licked it, like, dumb, go... take care of yourself like a mom would, you know, like what is that?
Oh my god.
But yeah, any thoughts or opinions on this little insert?
You know, like I still don't love this scene. It feels very weak to me. Mm-hmm. But I did like it more watching it the second time. I was able to kind of like relax and be like, you know what, okay, fine, like it's not like wretched, but like I don't love it. I think it's, like I said, I think it's pretty weak.
I got the sense that they had logistic and budget issues or something. Like, I feel like it might have been more effective if they just had one wolf and, like, shot it, like, covered it differently or something. You know what I mean? Or, like, I'm sure they didn't want to do CG, but I got the sense, like, having all those wolves there was a production, you know? And it didn't work out the best, you know?
Right. I feel like maybe one larger wolf would have been one, maybe two larger wolves would have been better, you know. But whatever.
I was admittedly thinking about this scene as I was going on a hike Saturday because, you know, I downloaded the map from All Trails and I always like read the reviews to see what's going on. You know, people say this is closed or, you know, there's a lot of water. And someone said, oh, I did this yesterday, but I had to turn around because there was a mama bear and two cubs. And I was like, oh, am I going to die today? just like city slicker going on my like Saturday hike. And I was thinking about this scene with Perrin. I was like, maybe if I just stay really still and turn around.
Yeah.
But I'm like, what? Like, I don't know that much about bears. I don't have bear spray. What does bear spray do anyway?
I don't know. I think I think bears, you're supposed to play dead, but don't quote me on that. Please.
Drag you back to your den for dinner.
Please don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure play dead is the move for bears.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so moving along, Rand is collecting some firewood and Egwene is like following him, and there's a kind of reconciliation that happens where, you know, she expresses what she's going through, like, don't you realize I'm not going to be a wisdom? Nynaeve is gone. Like, I'm dealing with all this and you are, you know, important to me, and now you won't even look at me. You're like, I feel like you hate me. And then very sappy, Rand's like, I could never hate you. And so they have a nice sort of reconciliation. Moraine, on the other hand, not doing well. She's fading pretty quickly. She looks like she has a fever. Lan looks stressed as fuck. Like, someone needs to give Lan a Xanax.
Seriously, he's not doing well. He's like, I gotta deal with these fucking kids. What the fuck? Like,
mom, the babysitter's dead. Like,
what the fuck? I did not sign up for this.
Yeah, so things kind of wind down for the night. They're all sleeping around a campfire. Egwene is the first to be startled by a sound, and then we see, not far away at all, fucking Fade screams, harrowing at the top of its lungs, and so the Trolloc army has found them. So Moraine is not even able to ride or wake up, so like she's basically like thrown onto a horse. Everyone saddles up, and Lan reads them to Shadow Lagoth. This I'll talk about with Tigraine, but one thing that annoyed me is they call it the Fallen City of Shadow Lagoth. Mm. And I'm like the name in the books is Eridol. To me, it's like the Fallen City of Eridol, and that city is called Shadow Lagoth. But Shadow Lagoth didn't fall. It's what came after. Anyway, I'm being annoying, but I just like it kind of.
Right. Like, did he say Eridol? I don't remember. Did he say Eridol?
No. No, they never say it. So
they always call it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're just simplifying things. I think that's what it is.
I know.
I don't think Eridol exists. So that's I think that's why. But I understand your annoyance. I get it.
Yeah. I mean, it's old tongue. You can't just make it up. Like.
Yeah.
So we get to this huge wall with like a fissure like cracked down it, and the Trolloc army will not approach. Which I found kind of interesting. I'm like, I feel like the Trolloc army would be a little bolder than that until you're like inside the walls. But
same.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Same. I agree. Right? I mean, you get the point, but I think you got to get in there before they're going to stop.
Yeah.
Before they're going to hesitate. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought so. They enter the city. One thing I noticed, and I don't love it, but I don't mind it because it is obviously intentional, but there's zero sound when they enter, and they call it out, like, there's no bugs, there's nothing. But I did think that there should be sound design. Like, when they go into the building, there's, like, a small drone, but because there was, like, literally nothing, it didn't actually read as eerie. It was just kind of, like, I needed some sound effects, sound design to like give me that foreboding thing. Otherwise, it's just like walking onto a quiet set, and it wasn't effective.
I agree with that. I think that I think you can add sound design that like. I mean, I'm not a sound designer, so I can't say exactly how to do this. But I think you can add sound design that will like give the idea of like decay or kind of just like, just a vacant city. I think like echoing, like some like rocks, like pebbles falling in the distance or some shit. You know what I mean? Like something like that. I think could be helpful in that instance.
Yeah, I'm glad you agree. They do bring that in later, but it's just like when they first arrive, that's what happens. So they get everyone in. Lan, gets everyone inside. They leave the horses outside. Lan's trying to explain to trying to babysit these kids, and we get this, it's not really a speech, but we get this line from Matt that is fucking hilarious. But he's like, a couple of things. One, that's more words than you've said all day, probably ever. And two, why in light's name did you bring us here? And he's not wrong. Like, Moraine did not want to go here, and Land clearly seems kind of in over his head. And he doesn't, he's just like, touch nothing, take nothing. And I'm like, Lan, you might want to give them like a little bit more. Like, that's not even like a proper response. Like,
yeah.
But I think he's mostly concerned with Moraine, who's like dying. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, so, but also yeah. like, we have to remember that he can like feel that.
Right? Yeah, you're
like,
right.
So he's doubly distracted, you know?
That's true. You're right. So while it's still daytime in Shadow Logoth, Rand goes exploring a little bit. We get this moment of him looking out over the city, like he climbs up to this tower. Egwene joins him and they hold hands, and it's kind of a nice moment. Mm-hmm. And then we also get this scene that it's one of my favorite scenes of the episode, actually. Matt and Perrin are back inside the building, and Matt says that he like loves Perrin, indirectly, but like he says like, you know, someone I love and that would be you, which is wonderful. And mm-hmm. I got the sense, like without it being said, I can just picture them back in the Two Rivers, like Matt, Layla, and Perrin like kicking it. Like they seem like people who would hang out, like have beers at the end of the night. Like Rand's up in the mountains, Egwene is, you know, on her high horse doing Egwene stuff. But it just seems like they were probably like all close friends. And so Matt really acknowledges the loss of Layla, and Layla had given him this like pretty fucking awesome like dagger knife. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how, you know, she didn't make weapons, she made tools. He gives it to Perrin, says like, keep it safe for me, keep it clean in case I need it later. And it's this tender moment. And it's just like another example of Matt trying to hold it together and look out for everyone. But also you can tell that he really cares for Perrin.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I like that concept of the three of them, you know, Matt, Perrin, and Layla, like kicking it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like having
playing
to be
playing D&D
like,
in the forge after they wrap up in
totally,
the
totally. Yeah. You can see Matt coming over with a joint, like, all right, dude, like, let's hang out.
Right? Yeah.
My sisters are in bed, you know, like, cool.
Yeah, I think so. So that was nice. Then later on, everyone is together inside the building, and we hear some whistling outside. And I think we'll revisit that with T'Grain, but there's a fucking whistle sound effect happening in this dead silent city. Matt awakens. He decides to go outside. Like, something's kind of got his attention. As he goes out, the horses are riled up. And he is kind of like, I don't know, chasing shadows, like weaving around. And he enters the space and finds this case, and he opens it, and there's a ruby-hilted dagger. Which is convenient because he just gave away his dagger to Perrin. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I don't want to go into spoilers now, but any thoughts here or thoughts on the dagger design that you'd like to share? Because it is pretty different.
I think like the way that he's like, just the way he kind of finds the dagger, like it's the way that they do it. It's obvious that like something is leading him there. You know what I mean? He's kind of like being led there. Which I think is important to point out. They're just kind of like things happening that kind of like and to keep enticing him around certain corners, you know, until he gets to this spot. And also like the fact that like when he leaves that the little like enclosure that they're staying in, it's pretty like overcast outside. But mm-hmm. when he finds that dagger, there's like a beam of light on it. You know, it's like
you're right. Just funny.
Like what the fuck? So I don't know, that's weird, but I think I like the dagger design. You know, it does deviate from the book, but I think it reads well on camera. I think it's still just as fucking cool. Like, sure, in the book it's a ruby hilted dagger, but like, is this not a cool dagger too? Like, you know,
I like the design. I was gonna say, I agree. And I think it makes way more sense for like balance. I know much about weapons, but to have it like embedded like that versus like to have like a big rock at the end or that you might break, like if you wanted to use the pommel of your dagger or something.
Sure. It's still a fucking cool dagger. I would probably have taken it too.
So, you know, then everyone is back inside again, and I think maybe the horses like reeling wakes them up, but like Two Rivers kids like run outside, and this is the chapter I'll call Artax. No, not Artax, but like we lose a horse. Horse down, like shadows are alive, they're crawling across every surface, consuming everything in its path. Pretty scary. This part, like, I mean, it's better, but it does remind me of like some Doctor Who episodes that I really enjoyed. There's some things like this, like that consume anything in its path. So the Two Rivers kids get separated into two groups, Perrin and Egwene on one side and Matt and Rand on the other. You know, Rand is clearly reluctant to leave Egwene, but she's like, you know, we'll find each other. They run their separate ways. I really enjoyed Rand and Matt pairing up. They encounter like a gate that's like a dead end, and Rand's like, hoist me up, and Matt's like, why don't you hoist me up? And he's like, just do it, Matt, like now's not the time. But just that little bit of comic relief was nice. And you know, Perrin and Egwene end up running upstairs to like the top of the city wall. Basically they have to jump off it into the water to escape. Rand and Matt find like a hatch and like get out the other side, and then of course Moraine wakes up and is like, you've killed us all, and Lan's just concerned with getting her the fuck out of there.
Well, I love his face after she says that, like the shame in his face is so fantastic. Oh my god. So good. But I also want to say, like, the part where like Perrin and Egwene are running, and they're running to like the top of like the parapet or whatever, the wall. And it actually like kind of pissed me off because Perrin's like taking it one step. Perrin's a big guy and he's taking the steps one at a time, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, man? Like, get up those fucking stairs. Yeah.
He's like, do 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 do.
Yeah, he's like, do 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 do.
Good for my calves.
What the fuck? I take two steps at a time normally. Like, if I'm running from a fucking evil presence, you best believe I'm going to be, like, galloping up those stairs.
Maybe he skipped leg day. He's like...
Oh, yeah, he is hurt. Oh, yeah, that's right. He's got a hurt leg wound. That's right.
Oh, yeah, that's what...
No, fuck that. Like, no, yeah. Fuck that.
Yeah. When your adrenaline is up, yeah, right now, like, you're not worried about a little scratch.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Oh, my gosh. So they make it out. Rand still wants to, like, go find them, and Matt's like, dude, we gotta just get out of here, you know? So they're all on separate sides of the city, basically. Lan gets Moraine out on horseback. He's, like, trying to tend to her. And then a knife is put to his throat, and we get cut to Nynaeve, who, fuck yeah, is alive. And she fuck just says, yes. She's like, if you don't take me to them right now, I'll slit your throat. And then, so you know, fade to black is a pretty great way to end the episode.
I definitely like rewatching that today, even though I've seen that episode like 5 times already. Like, when she did that, I was like, fuck yeah! Just like screamed in my apartment. So good.
Oh my god. My overall takeaway from this is that it was a really well written episode, especially for book fans and TV fans alike. I think Uta Brisewitz, gave us like really good direction, aside from Master Hightower, but what can you do? And, you know, it's not like it was bad cinematography, but like, I just feel let down. Like, his shots are really simplistic and expected, and that's why a lot of times, even though they built this entire city that's beautiful and gorgeous, like, it just feels cheaper, like a little more like network television, rather than like a prestige show. And so, sorry, but that's my biggest criticism. Like, I'm not a fan. It shows competency, but I don't think it shows like the same level of like taste or like what I want to see. Anyway.
Yeah, it's not really giving anything new, you know? It's like doing its job, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's unfortunate. But also there's Rosamund Pike, so thank God.
Oh my God, yes. So. Any closing thoughts before we go into our spoiler-filled discussion?
I don't think so. I was just thinking about how, like, when Perrin and, like, Egwene jump off that wall, like, they're fucking lucky that, like, because the other part of the wall where Matt and Rand come out, like, there's, like, ground right there. Like,
yeah.
And it would have been, you know what I mean? Like, they would have, like, fucking killed
died.
Themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I like,
mean,
I think about that
choice.
Every time I watch that. Every time. Yeah, but they could have, I would have jumped as far out as possible. You know what I mean? Come on. Get away from the wall.
Okay, you're right. Okay, two things. One, Tavirin. So they just came out the right side of the city.
Right.
Two, though, yeah, the way they, like, they, you see them jump and then it cuts.
Yeah,
to
they
them
just jump
in
down.
Water,
yeah.
But they're, like, right in front. And you're totally
yeah.
right. Like, no, you jump away. You
away.
Died on the wall on your way down.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was like, that was just like a direction thing. Like, just put them like 5 feet more away from this wall because it looks like.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I think about that every time. I'm like, they're gonna snap their necks on this fucking like
yeah.
beach, you know.
And then Egwene died, and then Perrin wandered the earth in solitude, hoping that a wolf would eat him.
Wow.
Okay. All right. Next up, we'll be joined by Tigraine of Twitter of Time to talk about all things spoilers. All right, welcome to Grain. We're ready to dive in with full spoilers. So if you have not completed either your season watch of the show or the book series, please hang up and dial again. So it's about to get fun. All right, so episode 2, Shadows Waiting. Is this the first time you've rewatched it since we all watched together, Tigraine?
No, this is the third time I've watched it.
Okay.
No,
it was
wait,
my
the
third
fourth
time,
time
as well.
The fourth time.
Fourth time?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so like my opening question to both of you, and maybe Zoe, you want to go first, but how has your overall like sentiment or like review of this episode shifted? Did you feel like you had a really different experience or opinion watching it this time around versus the first time we watched it together?
I would say it has shifted. I would say more so though the third time I watched it, because I watched it in like a binge format all the way through, and I just mm-hmm. had a much better appreciation for the first half of the season after that, after seeing the second half.
Yeah.
And then also just binging it, because it just flowed together much better, in my opinion.
Yeah, totally. Colin, what about you?
This is the first time we've watched it in a long time. So, like, I haven't watched it since maybe the second week of January. Mm-hmm. So that I've had some distance from it. And I liked it more. I liked just being able to, like, now that I know what happens, you know, like, I can just kind of like relax and watch the story and not really think too much about it, and kind of let them tell their story. And so I think I was definitely less, not that I wasn't critical, but I was less like acutely critical rewatching it than I was the first time I watched it. That's for sure. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I said earlier that I felt like it was really hard the first time not to be swayed or influenced by other people's point of view. So there was like criticisms around the pacing and how rushed it felt, or like not getting enough time with the Two Rivers folks. And rewatching it, I didn't feel that way at all. And sort of like both your points of like, one, watching it in context of like watching the whole season through and how it like all links together, but to your point as well, Colin, of like knowing that everything's going to be okay, so I don't have to like stress and have my like critical brain on the entire time we're watching this.
Yeah.
So that's good to hear that we all had if anything, like a better viewing experience the second time around. All right. As sort of an icebreaker, each of you, whoever wants to start, pick one thing in the episode that just really annoyed you or stood out to you, like that you've that's been rolling around in your head.
Do you want to go
first?
Someone
go first.
I think one thing that really stood out to me in this was when they were doing the ferry scene and they cut across the river and the ferry owner is freaking out about my son is coming and he has to go back. Lan like tries to give him more money and I just never noticed that before and it was just hysterical to me because Lan's like trying to shove him like more coins as the Trollocs and like Merdral are coming up. Like, sorry, dude. Like, here's more money to make it better.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That was really funny to me.
And that is kind of from the books, isn't it?
I if it like, is, I don't remember. Money. I just thought it was hysterical.
Oh, my gosh.
The guy was not having it.
It's funny that you say that because the one thing, the nitpicky thing that stood out to me this time was Master Hightower. I was telling Colin earlier, like, I do not like the casting. It's like he's reading from, like, Saturday Night Live teleprompter. And he's like, oh, what? What are they? My family? Oh, no. Like, he has, like, the same tone and expression the entire time. And just, like, I'm like, this guy needs to be more tactile. Like, he should be drunk or angry or, like, have any range of emotions at all. But, like, Rosamund Pike's so nuanced and, like, amazing. And all the actors are, like, striking these perfect reactions as actual monsters, like, pile onto the ferry. And Hightower's like, oh, what's going on? Like, I don't know. It's just like really funny to me. But that was my like nitpicky thing. I was like, that's recast funny. Hightower.
I love it.
All right, Colin.
Mine is the last thing I said at the end of the episode was when they jump and like they don't jump far enough, like Matt and Perrin. Or like Perrin and Egwene. Like, they're gonna die. Like, there's no way. Like, you gotta like, get a running leap or as far as away from that wall as you can. Or you're gonna, like, you know what I mean? Like, that wall is, like, how many feet high? It's crazy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're gonna mid-Samar.
Like, yeah. Yeah, seriously. Exactly.
Colin was also saying... Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just saying I didn't even think of that when I saw it.
Colin was also saying, like, good thing they jumped not on the side that Ran and Matt came out of, because that was, like, really shallow waters.
It was just beach. There was just ground. Literally, like, they would have fallen onto the ground.
What else were they going to do?
Crazy.
Oh, man. Okay, so those are some fun hot topics. All right, so we're short on time, so I'm not going to go into too much. One thing that stood out to me on rewatching this in a positive way is I feel like there were a lot of nods to Rand being the Dragon Reborn. Like, the way it was edited, there were a lot of these just, like, focusing on Rand, literally just, like, gazing and thinking and, like, processing. And it starts off in Terran Ferry, at the ferry, like, there's a scene where they cut between the Fade, who's just screamed, directly to Rand and only Rand. And it's, like, almost like this face-off moment. Like, I just feel like it's, like, getting Rand ready to fade. Like, he's the most in direct opposition to these forces. They're ultimately after him. And then Colin pointed this out. Right after, as they're, like, leaving the ferry, there's a super long sequence just cutting back and forth of Lan looking at Rand, and Rand looking at Lan, and Lan looking at Rand. And I'm just like, well, okay. Are you trying to tell us, like, what is happening here? Like,
I think they're flirting. Actually? I think it's just, like, Nynaeve and Lan later on. Later in the
day. Yeah. He thought Nynaeve was dead, so it was Rand's turn.
there was that which I felt like was a big tip off. Then, like, the dream the dream happens first from Rand's point of view, and then he has that face off with Moraine. And I felt like that was a bit of a tell, just like how much focus there was on Rand. And I don't know, then there's like this shot of him just looking out over Shadow Logoth, and just the way they were kind of soloing him in a way that they're not doing the other characters. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
That's
like
true.
These
yeah.
hero shots of him. Like looking back, I was like, oh, yeah, there's definitely some clues happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's true. Especially the surveying shot, because like Shadow Logoth becomes like pivotal like later on, like a couple times.
So, right?
Like looking at that location, yeah.
Yeah, I thought there were like some fun shots that are going to pay off later, like that mm-hmm. one. But it's cool because it's more Robert Jordan planted that, and now we get to see it show up on film. Like right. the story of Manetherin, obviously, was like a really pivotal moment in this episode and like so amazing for book fans to see, but play out in a new way. But whenever I hear that story with Eldraine, it like directly foreshadows and like recalls what Egwene is going to do at the last battle. You know, like the way she burns herself out, but like in the process Absolutely. Is like this momentous thing. And like, I always loved how, you know, she is from Manetherin, and I imagine she was like maybe more direct descendant or something. So just mm-hmm. to like see the seeds being planted was like exciting to me as a fan. Things that we'll come back to. I don't know. Were there any like nerd things that came to mind for you?
I think I noticed the same thing. Like even when it's just like a quick cut of them resting on a cliff and Rand's the only one standing and stuff like that. So I definitely mm-hmm. noticed that. I also wondered if that was from a cut scene because it was kind of just like a really quick, like 2 seconds. They're just on a cliff hanging out and then they're back on the road. And it wasn't really given like a huge explanation of like, were they just resting or whatever? So yeah, I definitely noticed that as well.
All right. We're short on time today. We have about 15 minutes. So I'm just like going to hit on like the hot topics that I think of this episode. So, among the pet peeves is a part I call Perrin, the wolves and the wound. So, you know, Colin and I were just talking about this like fucking wound. It's just, it never pays off. It's like, there's this awkward wolf seed where, I guess like, is that Dapple? Like just licks it and then walks away. It's just like, it's like the only job they give Perrin this episode. Everyone else like got to shine. But he's sad, like Brandon said. He's just sad, and he's got a leg wound.
It's just like, it just pisses me off that, like, it never comes to fruition. Like, nothing, you know what I mean? It's just like, that's the part that annoys me about it. It's like, what the fuck was up with this fucking thing, you know?
Oh, my God.
It's so annoying. But also, I just noticed this, like, the last time I watched it, and there's this moment when the wound is first introduced, right before that, the shot before that, they're kind of like, we're kind of looking at the bonfire, and the bonfire plays in reverse. It's almost like some Twin Peaks shit. Like, did you guys notice that?
No.
Like, the fire's, like, crackling, and then it reverses, and the smoke, like, comes back.
Oh, my God.
Where was that at?
It's just a very quick thing. I don't even know if it means anything, but, like, it's, like, right, and it's right at the scene where Perrin first rolls his pants leg up, and you see the wound.
Oh.
And he's by the bonfire by himself, and then Egwene comes over later.
Yeah.
He's, like, when he's looking at it by himself, right before they show the wound, you're kind of where the camera's on the bonfire, and it like plays in reverse. It plays forward, and
it's
then it plays immediately.
It's got to be an editing mistake.
I think it's an editing mistake.
I'm gonna have Matt look at it.
I think like, that's what it looked like. But I was like, that's weird. I didn't notice it before, but I noticed it this time. It was weird. Anyway, that's that.
Yeah. Okay, we can all agree. Not Perrin just gets the short end of the stick.
He really did.
Okay, next on my list of hot topics is Lan. So, as you recall, I was like the most, like, having a hard time adjusting to the TV Lan at this point, like when we watched the first 3 episodes. And rewatching this again, there's 2 things that stand out to me. Like, regardless of the book, I just feel like Lan should feel more dangerous. Like, it's okay that he has these, like, other qualities and is fleshed out, but I want him to exude, like, a sense of danger, like that he's really insanely talented and hardened, like, even though he's like all these other things. But he is definitely like just so stressed and like kind of meek was the word I put in this episode. Mm-hmm. That, and it's so early in the season that I was like, I still like, I don't know. Yeah. I just wish he was like a little, yeah, that's all. And he didn't notice that Valda's Aes Sedai rings. Moraine had to point that out to him. And I'm like,
right.
Lan should be like crazy scout. Eagly, like, doesn't miss anything. Yeah.
No, that's true. That's true. I think, like, okay, so this was my thought, and this ties back into, like, the moment at the Terran. Mm-hmm. I think that's what is attempting to be, like, conveyed is Lan being dangerous. That's what these intense looks are. Like, mm-hmm. that moment when he's looking at Rand, and then there's another moment, like, after the argument between Egwene and Rand, and they all, and Matt's like, come on, let's go. She throws fireballs, let's go. And Lan's like, when they ride by, Lan's like staring at them from behind this rock.
Yeah.
I think those moments are meant to, like, convey, like, this dude is watching and he's kind of dangerous and you should look out. I think that's the point of those things, but they're not landing. Like, I agree with you. They're not my
Daniel name. Henney can't help but, like, be smoldering, not scary. Yeah. Like,
right. Yeah. They're just not landing, unfortunately.
All right, Tigraine, what is your opinion on this?
So, I didn't notice this at first, but I actually think he's probably the one struggling the most with the accent. Whatever they're being coached on to do, he, like, changes it a lot. And I noticed when he was doing his lines about, it was once called Erdal, it means shadow waiting, blah blah blah, it was just so, like, it felt like it was a struggle for him to get out. I didn't really believe it. It just wasn't there for me. I also agree with you, like, he doesn't feel dangerous. I think we're missing some of the reactions to Blademaster swords that we get in the books, which are like an instant alert to someone, like the White Cloaks, that you can't mess with this person. And obviously that should be happening to Rand and Lan. And I agree. I just don't think he comes off as particularly dangerous and, or even necessarily like competent. I do like that they've made him have a little more like emotional depth and stuff. But even just them going into the city, like, it was nighttime. The Trollocs and the Myrdral show up as they're running. Dawn comes and they go into Shatter Logoth. Why don't you just ride through the city and exit? Like, I didn't fully understand that, unless the city's surrounded on all three sides by water. Like, I just didn't understand why. But then you see them, Matt and Rand, be able to leave through the water, so it shouldn't matter. So I just was like, why would he stay there for a full day and a full night? Like,
I think he was worried about Moraine, you know, which I think is kind of what they use in the book too. But here Moraine's sicker in the book. She's weaker because she channels against all the Trollocs, so we get that like awesome showdown, which we don't get here. But yeah, they did have a lot of time to like go to the gift shop and like get a ruby hilted dagger and like
or just like rest during the day and leave when it's nightfall, since you know nightfall is when it gets weird, you know. Like, I didn't understand. I didn't understand, like, it doesn't make sense to just like stay there. If they had been interrupted, like, or the Trollocs had come, like, and it was evening and they couldn't help it, it would have made more sense. But it was literally night, they get woken up, it becomes dawn as they run. They're there all day, you know. So to me, it just didn't make sense. And just seeing kind of him struggle a little bit when he does have speaking. I know there's like a later episode where he kind of struggled and like changed his accent in like the middle of a conversation too. And I'm just not sure he's quite there yet. I'm hoping he's better in season two.
And I mean, I agree. And I feel like, you know, just thinking back to the first time we watched it, we all felt similarly, and we maybe weren't able to like articulate it like quite what it was, but now we can like pinpoint it. But I do think it gets stronger as it goes on, because I was skeptical at this point, and then as it went on, I felt like he got more confident, he like settled into it, and it's starting to like fit him, you know. Whereas I think it was probably like a learning curve and just like trying things out. But yeah,
I think that I mean, he did talk about he was having a tough time. He's joked about it before and mentioned mm-hmm. that like he was having a tough time. And I think we know that he was also like having a tough time with like the role in general and kind of like living up to that, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it was a very high profile thing for him. So I think he's definitely, he was dealing with some challenges, you know, which is okay. We all do. And that's cool. But I think to Jay's point, I think he also does get better, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. over the course of the season. So.
Yeah. Okay. So now I feel bad. Sorry.
No. Feel bad.
Yeah. No, it was, I'm glad you reminded me that he has been, vulnerable and open about that and like mm-hmm. a challenge that he's taking on and like working at, which is admirable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we have a few minutes left. While we're talking about Shatter Lagoth, right before like Matt kind of wakes up and he like decides to go out, we hear a whistling. And obviously, like, we hear whistling whenever it's supposed to be Padawan Fane, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what is up? Like, do you think Padawan Fane is sort of leading him to the dagger? Because Mashadar, the way it's manifested in the TV show, not like that
shows
it's like
up with the whistling.
Yeah, like, I don't know. It's different here. And well, okay, you know, there's not like a sentient evil in this version. Mm-hmm. It's like a shadow. It's like a mindless sort of thing that's gonna kill you, or it feels mindless. It's chasing you, but like they don't meet the what's his face.
Mm-hmm.
Mordeth. They don't mean Mordeth. So I'm like, Fane is kind of, is he sort of taking that place? Like, is he related to this dagger setup? So, because it happens, and then Matt goes out, and then he finds the dagger, and we never know, like, what is Padawan Fane doing? Like, he's just following them.
I think that, I don't know if we can answer the question, honestly, but I mm-hmm. do, part of me I feel split on this. Part of me feels like it's just lazy. Like, they wanted to, like, they had to like insert Padawan Fane somehow, his presence somehow, so that's where they put it, you know. Mm-hmm. But the other part of me wonders, and they brought this up before, like talking about how Padawan Fane becomes linked to the dagger, and like I guess maybe like the way they're doing it now, the way you guys said it, like it happens later. It happens once he mm-hmm. once he gets it later in the season. But I'm wondering now if somehow he is linked to Mashadar. Like, in the same way that he gets away from Machin Shen, he also gets away from Mashadar. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Maybe it touches him and he loses a toe. You know, I don't know. Like, but he's now tainted by it. You know, I don't really know. But having the whistle occur, overlapping the visual of Mashadar creeping into the city mm-hmm. does suggest some connection. But on the other hand, I'm kind of like, nah, it's just lazy. I don't know. I really don't know the answer.
Yeah, we really don't know. I don't think there is like a firm answer, which is an interesting choice. So I wonder if we will get tipped off to anything later on.
Mm-hmm. If he is possessed by him, it makes the last battle make a little more sense mm-hmm. with how mm-hmm. everything went down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been saying there's got to be another element that we don't know about Fane. Mm-hmm. We don't know anything, really. He just rolls up with Fades, smiling everywhere he goes.
He's very confident. Like, we know that.
That's all we know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess we can assume that they're going to develop him, because now we know the main characters, so that they can develop mm-hmm. Fane. You know, they can develop some other characters in the next season, so hopefully they'll do that in season two.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. Any closing thoughts on episode two? Spoilers?
I had one last question. So, like, the scene where, like, the Fade shows up and wakes them up right before they leave to go to Mashadar, Egwene is the one who wakes up. She's, like, dreaming, and she wakes up, and she senses it. Why doesn't Lan not sense any Shadow Spawn? Why? You know what I mean? Like, what's good up question. With that?
Why doesn't he?
Yeah. That's not his. That's not Daniel's fault. That's writing. That's a writing error. But like,
no, I'm kidding. kidding.
I don't know. It's just, that seems weird to me. I mean, I'm glad it happens for Egwene, but it seems weird that the warder wouldn't sense the presence.
You know? Yeah, it is a little odd.
Yeah, for sure.
That's it.
that's it. But there's a bunch we didn't get to. Egwene learning to channel, you know, she surrenders to the river and like the sounds of rushing water, which is different than the flower in the books. Thought that was interesting, but I feel like it's a more natural explanation. Like honestly, when I don't know what you guys thought, but the whole rosebud thing, I was like, I don't really know how to picture that. Like, I'm getting horny. Like, what am I supposed to be feeling? Like, Colin is laughing on mute. Yeah, there he
goes. Oh my god.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
If you went to the White Tower and you couldn't learn to channel because picturing a flower just makes you horny, can you imagine?
That's my block. Like, like, that would be my block.
I need another image. You need another image, yeah.
Another thing I thought, because this is only episode 2, there's a lot of fleeing on horseback, you know? And I thought, man, like, Moraine and Lam got so fucking lucky that these, like, kids can ride, like, really well. Because all I could think of is, like, Swan in the later books. Yeah. Like, fucking, like she can't, tame Bella. Like, she can't ride a pony. It's, like, hilarious to me that the Amaryllis Sea, like, can't ride a horse. They lucked out on that. Another just spoilery thought that I had is, you know, encountering the White Cloaks for the first time with Moraine and Egwene, and Egwene like observing and even making comments about how Moraine handled the situation. And all I could think about was like when Egwene encounters the White Cloaks outside the White Tower after she's been a captive of the Seanchan, and she has like PTSD, and she like starts blowing up the ground, and Varen's like, Egwene, stop it! Like, what are you doing? Just setting up that contrast of like Moraine handling White Cloaks versus like Egwene later losing her shit was fun for me to think about.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say like a nod and applause for the Shadow Spawn design. You know, we see more Trollocs, but we really get a lot of close-ups of like the Fade and the Fade's horse in this one, which I thought was fun. Mm. And I like the way that they bring them to life in these early episodes before COVID made them use all CG. So, you know, but. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I was a big fan of this episode. Thank you guys for breaking it down with me. Join us next time. We'll be talking about episode 3 and some other hot topics in the Randland weeks to come. So stay tuned.